Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
Hello, good morning. You're very welcome to the Off the Ball Sunday paper review here on Easter Sunday, and a happy Easter to you all as well. Neil Tracy here filling in for Joe Malloy this afternoon. Joining me today, we have one of our old hands on the paper review, Kieran Cunningham. How are you doing?
Good, thanks.
You managed to get a brief respite from the old family time this morning?
I did. I was supposed to be working, but I did a week's holiday last Sunday, ending last Sunday, but because of the John Delaney stuff, I worked that Sunday, so I managed to get the day off. So have some family stuff later on, dinner, so.
Very good.
And okay.
Also alongside as well, Rory Keane, Sunday pay-per-view debutant today.
Yeah. Long time listener,
first time caller. You're going to be heading to the Aviva later on this afternoon.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it now. I think if we're saying it out there, she has the makings of a classic, I think, you know.
Sun in the sky, perfect for Toulouse.
Yeah, Toulouse, Chesson, Colby, James Lowe, Jordan Larbour. Yeah.
What more could you ask for?
Yeah.
Exactly,
yeah. Happy days.
So we'll go straight into the headlines. As has been the case over the last few weeks, it's the front page of the Sunday Times where we are going first. They're leading with another scoop on the FAI governance. FAI payment to Delaney's ex-girlfriend. This is total of €60,000 in professional fees recorded for 2013-2014. This is another scoop by Mark Tighe and Paul Rowan as well. So John Delaney issued an instruction, they say, to the FAI's finance department to pay his then-girlfriend €15,000 in 2014. Internal records from the Sunday Times show. We'll be talking a bit more about that shortly. Neither Delaney, who's been on gardening leave since Monday, nor the FAI, they say, has offered an explanation as to what the payments were for. The former girlfriend of John Delaney in question, Susan Keegan, she has denied receiving any payment from the FAI or John Delaney. In the sports section of the Sunday Times, they lead with a picture from yesterday's action at the Ricoh Arena. Down and out, Munster dream over after 32-16 loss to Sarries in Euro semi-final. It's a photo of Alex Lazowski and David Strettel tackling Munster's Mike Haley during yesterday's defeat at the Ricoh Arena. And also there, a small picture towards the bottom of Billy Vunipola when he was confronted on the pitch by a Munster fan after the game. That Munster fan was detained by the stadium security. On the back page of the Sunday Independent, they also lead with Munster's defeat. End of the road. Munster blown away by ruthless Saracens. Picture of Tadhg Byrne looking forlorn yesterday at the Ricoh Arena after yesterday's defeat. And also the bottom, United's underperformers handed an ultimatum. That is after Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has apparently started to lay down the law on a few of his underperforming players after the defeat against Barcelona during the week. 5 defeats out of 7 games now for them. And they're away to Everton this afternoon. You can hear that on Off the Ball. On the Irish Mail on Sunday, a sorry state, second best Munster run ragged as they slip to yet another semi-final defeat. And this time the pictures of Peter O'Mahony at the Ricoh Arena yesterday. Saracens 32, Munster 16. We'll be talking about the reaction to that game in just a few moments' time. On the Sunday Mirror, they lead with a picture of Phil Foden and his Manchester City teammates celebrating his goal yesterday. Pep, my finest hour if I win second title with City. Pep Guardiola says his achievements at Man City will rank among the proudest of his career, even if they fail to defend their championship or their Premier League title. And then, oh man, Solskjaer, no quick fix. It's going to take years to sort out this United team. A lot of work for United to do in the summer in the transfer market. The Sunday World also go with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. Solskjaer says, we'll gift pool title. United boss to eat toffees, then bash City. Most importantly for United, of course, they are playing Man City on Wednesday night, and a win there would go a long way to giving Liverpool their first title in, 29 years. But a long way to go there. It's hard to see them beating Man City in the form they're in at the moment. And also then on the back page of the Irish Sun, kicking De Bruyne. That is after Kevin De Bruyne went off injured yesterday. Fears season is over for Kevin. It looked an innocuous enough injury yesterday. He was able to walk off the pitch, but Pep Guardiola said he didn't know too much about his injury. They're hopeful it's not going to be too long, but with just a few games left really in the season, it could be a season ender, even if it isn't that serious. Guys, I think the first place we have to start again this week is the front page of the Sunday Times and Mark Tighe's latest big scoop on the FAI governance and John Delaney.
Yeah, this is another incredible story that Mark has unearthed, and Paul Rowan has worked on it with him as well. Like, even the headline, like, you don't expect to see headlines like that: FAI payment to Delaney's ex-girlfriend. And it goes back to his previous the relationship before the one he's in at the moment with a woman called Susan Keegan, and that the FAI's accountancy system recorded a total of 60,000 of professional fee payments in the name of Susan Keegan in late 2013, early 2014. And there's been no explanation from either John Delaney or in the FAI as to what these payments were for. And it's interesting that all this stuff has come out, because a lot of stuff has been talked about, or a lot of papers and different media outlets have got wind of different stories over the years, but they haven't, and some of them, this isn't a total surprise that this came out, because we kind of, you know, this kind of stuff has been going around, but nobody's been able to back it up. And clearly Mark has very good information now that he's able to back it up and get it across the line.
As he says, the internal record seen by the Sunday Times. He's seen these documents.
Yeah, but like, there's at least one whistleblower now, because, you know, to get a credit card bill, you know, you need somebody who's within the system leaking it. But it does show you because I do see stuff out there and saying, oh, this expo shows up how poor football journalists are, that Mark Tyer, news journalist, got all this. But a lot of football journalists knew a lot of stuff that was happening, but weren't able to get it across the line, or were being bullied and threatened by the FAI. Because, like, I remember there was one particular, we had a previous editor called Ger Colleran, and one of the things he did was every time we mentioned John Delaney, you would have to, John Delaney, comma, who was paid whatever it was at the time, 400,000 a year, comma. So he always wanted to keep highlighting the salary. So it was an issue for a long time. But I remember they were always looking for clarifications, and every newspaper would tell you that, the FAI and John Delaney. And one particular day, we had three clarifications, one on top of the other, for stories. And a clarification doesn't necessarily mean, or you might necessarily have got a story wrong to have to print a clarification, but it's part of the libel laws here that It's so hard to get stuff out there. Like, this is one of the great victories for journalism, that Mark and the Sunday Times have managed to get the stuff out there. And it's been, there have been a lot of FAI scandals over the years, but generally there were one big incident. Like, it was some big scandal about tickets at the 94 World Cup or whatever. But this is the drip feed, as was mentioned, the Roctus Committee during the week. It's day after day, week after week, more stuff comes out. And there's no way back. Like, some people are saying, oh, you know, John Delaney, you know, he's on gardener leave. He could conceivably come back. But his phone and his FAI credit card were taken off him last week. And a thing like that, I don't see how there's any way back from that story. Like, how can you explain that? Like we came to expect stuff, accept stuff that was completely off the wall. Like, if you look online at the photos of the Euro 2016 draw, you're Roy Keane, Martin O'Neill, sitting together, John Delaney beside them, and beside John Delaney, Emma English's girlfriend. Like, what was her role at a big draw like that? Mm-hmm. You know, it did look like somebody who was making his own rules and who thought he was untouchable, which is a very common thing in Ireland over the years. And it's good that it does look like chickens are coming home to roost.
Yeah, and as they point out in the article here, it says that in response to questions, John Tracy, the chief executive of Sport Ireland, says that this is clearly part of the terms of reference for the Mazars investigation. This total 60,000 professional fees, as they say as well. Susan Keegan, his ex-girlfriend, she denies receiving any payments from Delaney or from the FAI. The Sunday Times, though, they say that they have seen an email sent by Delaney to the FAI's finance department on February 3rd, 2014, under the subject 15K Susan Keegan. Delaney asked, can you transfer 15K to the account? It's agreed with Michael Cody and Eddie Murray as an overall payment of €50,000. They do say the FAI's internal accounts show a payment of €15,000 recorded in the name of Keegan 3 days later on February 6th. In total, the FAI noted at least three payments to the name of Keegan totaling €60,000. What we don't know is, you know, what these payments were for. Mm. There could be a legitimate explanation for, you know, services provided. It's the fact that the FAI haven't commented on these. It's, you know, it's where the doubt is constantly arising that they aren't providing the information. And we would have seen there's a story in the Sunday Times or in the Sunday Independent about Cricket Ireland CEO Warren Dietram today.
Yeah.
Who would have given his association a loan of €100,000. But as we'll get to in a few minutes on that story, there is a lot of information there. They've given out the information, and everything, as we can see, this all looks fine.
Yeah, it looks to be above board.
It's reassuring to see all that information.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the interesting things about this, like Eddie Murray, who resigned on Monday, was the FAI's honorary treasurer for and has been for was for a number of quite a long time. And he has no recollection of approving the payment for Keegan, and he doesn't recall ever hearing her name before. Mm-hmm. And he is the treasurer. So surely that sets alarm bells ringing, like what on earth is this about? If it's mentioned in the accountancy system, the FAI aren't commenting on it, and the woman herself says she knows nothing about it. Like, it's really strange. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's strange. I think it was a good, just come back to a point Kieran there, said there about Mark. I think that's a really good point that, you know, go back to think about the football lads missed a beat here. I think sometimes having someone who isn't on the beat and isn't compromised by, you know, is my access, you know, bro's talking about access now, even in rugby, you know, getting access to players and pressers, you know, without that kind of fear of it, you could just kind of go after this info and go after, you know, you can go and chase these things. I think it's, you know, he's done really, really well in fairness to him.
You know. And you get the feeling there probably are, there's another story in the pipeline next week. There's probably another one down the line a week later.
Yeah.
I would think so, because a lot of those board members are there a long time. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to imagine when you hear stuff like this, that there isn't more to it. You know, that if this is the kind of practice, if these are the kind of practices that went on, it's a leap of faith to think it's just the odd isolated incident over 14, 15 years. So
I think Paul Rowan does a good job in the sports section of the Sunday Times, going kind of into detail about just how much there is needed to be done at the FAI with what we know now that all the board are going to be stepping aside at the next AGM.
That's one thing I find interesting, Neil. There's a huge argument for that they all should go en masse. But at the same time, it does raise, like, it does raise the issue then, who runs the FAI? Mm-hmm. Like, you're suddenly bringing in people, a completely new board. I know there's full-time staff there, and hopefully they can keep things ticking over. But it is a massive sport in Ireland. And to lose all the people who've been at the top for a long, long time does present huge challenges as well. And there's no guarantee you get the right people coming in. Like, it's where do those people come from? Are they coming from the FAI Council, who would have been involved in putting the board in place that's been there for such a long time? You don't know. Like, it's do you go outside? Like, the Genesis report did recommend having independent members of the board. And it's something Sport Ireland should really have insisted on. And now they're talking about doing it, but it should have been insisted on a long, long time ago.
Yeah, and there's just, you know, it's really starting from scratch at the very, very top. It's not just replacing a CEO now, as we would have thought, when did this first break? 6 weeks ago or so? Yeah. Barely a month ago. There's so much that's going to be changing at the top of the FAI. Like, when are we actually going to be seeing the first shoots of this, you know, is this even the report itself? How long are we going to be waiting to see this?
I would say a couple of months. Yeah. You know, that, like, the AGM is down for July, isn't it? So that's when you really have to obviously put a new board in place. But like, who knows how this is going to pan out? Like, some of this could end up in court. You don't know. Mm-hmm. You don't know what's going to happen. Like, because there's just more and more stuff coming out all the time, and it's a huge opportunity as well as a huge challenge, mm-hmm. because you have the chance to remake, to redesign the future of Irish soccer, and if you get the right people in charge, like a lot of other sporting bodies here, it can make a massive difference. But I'm wary of messiahs. I'm wary of people saying, "No, Niall Quinn will come in and transform everything." Yeah. Or Brian Kerr, like Brian's expertise, I don't think would be board level. I think he should have some role, but like, you have to. Niall's track record in business is up and down, so, and he's also, he would be another celebrity administrator, which you mightn't want after the last one. So, I don't think you necessarily need football people. Like I mentioned before, the likes of Gary Keegan, who's worked everything from rugby to sailing to boxing to hurling, you know, and he was CEO of the Institute of Sport. Like, people like that, that are top class operators, and there's a lot of them in Irish sport, I think, should be looked at, and Irish business, who've crossed over from sport to business.
Yeah, and you mentioned the notion of, like, you know, Niall Quinn would potentially be another celebrity administrator. Everyone knows who Niall Quinn is, an Irish football legend. It kind of brings us towards, there are some very good pieces in the Sunday Independent. They've done a nice They have got Brendan Fanning, their rugby writer Dermot Crowe from Gaelic Games, to kind of go through the governance of their associations. And Brendan Fanning is writing about Philip Brown, for example, the IRFU CEO, being essentially the anti-John Delaney. We know very little about him. A couple of interesting paragraphs. There are as many images of John Delaney, perhaps the most enduring is from Euro 2012, being carried aloft through the streets of Sopot in northern Poland by Irish fans who'd separated from his shoes and socks. Only one image of Philip Brown springs to mind, sitting behind a desk in the IRFU office. Occasionally, being the mad thing that he is, Brown might have his jacket off, but that would have been on instruction to convey the image of a hard-working leader. Brown, who is an unexciting, careful man, a classic product of South Dublin middle-class Protestant stock, essential IRFU, in other words.
It's Brendan always does this stuff really well. He's you know, he's been on the beat a long time, and like I think it's been referenced loads of times. He did a brilliant book years ago on you know, from there to here. And if anyone has read it, it's an essential read for a rugby fan or a sports fan. But yeah, it's a really good piece. It's just about like polar opposites. Like as I said, Kieran, I mean, Philip Brown
would have had to work very closely together given the relationship between the FAI and the IRFU.
Over the Aviva.
It's a good line there, like having the half-assed FAI close at hand always made for a good comparison.
Soccer struggled to clear its share of the stadium debt, rugby presented teacher with a neatly completed sum before the bell went for the end of class.
But what I like about this as well is balanced in that it shows the IRFU isn't perfect either. You know, it's got issues of its own. And this is something a lot of people might be aware of when he talks about the voting power extended to past presidents of the union, which is off the wall. Like, long after they served a one season in a blazer, they continue to vote at the EGM, and they're at home and away internationals. And this the power of this lobby derailed Finn Burke Crowley a couple of years ago from his journey to the president's chair. Crowley had been chairman of the management committee, and he was looked at as a rising star coming in, but he was derailed from the presidency because of the power of the ex-president. So it's and Philip Brown was very exasperated by this. Like, that's a kind of relic of the amateur rugby era, that's still allowed, and I'm surprised at that. Like, that they still have that kind of power.
What the pieces do well, I think, is it doesn't just present the fact that the FAI are a mess. There are problems with every governing body, really.
Yeah.
And Dermot Crowe is going into some of the issues in the GAA, where there's a lot of secrecy around how much people are being paid and about the governance as well.
Because he meant there's a lot in the Dermot Crowe piece. Like, there's a fair amount of it is about credit card use in the GAA and how you have to, you need to give very detailed explanations and receipts for anything that goes on an official credit card. But it does mention, you know, Galway had troubles last year with credit card use being official. Mm-hmm. So they're not immune to things. But the director, Michael Dignan in the Mail, talks about this as well, but there should be more transparency in the GAA over salaries. Like, we don't know what Tom Ryan, effectively the CEO of the GAA, is paid. The likes of Peter McKenna, who's a commercial director and the stadium manager in Croke Park, we don't know what he's paid. Mm-hmm. And we are given a lump sum, but it's never broken down. And the same with the GPA, we don't know what Paul Flynn is paid in the GPA. And they do get a lot of state funding, and I think they should be a bit more open about it. And like, there is somebody, he's not named here, but somebody says, look, it's no secret, the approximate figure. I've seen the figure of half of John Delaney's salary be mentioned, or even less than half. But that's very vague. Like, why not just say it? Danny Lynch, the former PRO, says, he said the DJ would probably be getting about a third of what John Delaney was getting, which would be about 120,000. Mm-hmm. And that's roughly what John Tracy gets, the CEO of Sport Ireland. So maybe that is the case. Mm-hmm. I would suspect that the CEO of the GA gets a bit more, Director General of the GA gets a bit more than 120,000, though. I'd be surprised if that's the case. But I don't know why they just don't come out and say it. Like, what is the issue?
Is part of it maybe that the GA has never really been strapped for cash? that they're not under as much pressure to actually tell us it?
I don't know. I don't know. What do you think, Rory? Like, do you think they should?
I suppose, as you said, if it's, you know, it's always that white line. But as you said, if there's a lot of state funding,
yeah,
you know, and a lot of public funding going into it, then, you know, there's no harm, and it'd be just be interesting to see how it tallies up with, you know, the football and the rugby in terms of, you know.
And like, given the turnover that RFU, I would think Philip Brown is on a quite hefty salary.
Yeah, but that's not made public. That's not made public. No, wouldn't really have known either.
Yeah, that's not made public. Like, so that's, I wouldn't say use it as a defence of John Delaney, but there were figures out there for what John Delaney got. We never really got figures for IRFU or the GA, which are the two other main, the biggest sporting bodies. Like, we do get figures for the likes of Sport Ireland because it's tied into civil service pay grades. Mm-hmm. So we get that.
Yeah. Do you think it kind of marries up with, you know, there's always this outroar when it comes out, like, what, you know, what people in RT are earning, or, you know, this kind of thing, you know, there's outrage. Does it, you think it sort of tallies up with that? Or,
possibly, yeah. Possibly, yeah. Yeah. But
there is a public interest, people, you know.
But I think because the GA and the IRFU are very successful, I think people would probably be accepting of the salaries. You know, they say, okay, we're turning a huge profit every year, or a decent profit every year. We've built these stadia, etc. And this is what the people in charge get. I think people say, yes, fair enough.
Probably the biggest noise of Irish soccer fans would have been of League of Ireland fans who'd be, you know, going to grounds every week that need heaps of improvement done. They're watching teams that some of which are probably struggling week to week to pay wages. And I think that's probably what would have jarred them to see the
I think that's what the outrage over Delaney is rooted in, because there were a lot of layoffs within the FAI and a lot of wage cuts. There was a great piece in the Killarney Advertiser this week. I think a guy called Adam Moynihan, I don't know if you read it, but he's involved in Kerry Soccer. But he was talking about you play cup finals in Kerry and soccer, and
players have to pay
into the game. Yeah. Yeah. So this stuff was going on while a guy was getting his rent paid, while he was getting all sorts of, spending thousands and thousands of credit cards over on nice shirts and Thomas Pink. Not a thousand of shirts, I have to clarify that, but thousands in general.
Is that the latest story, the shirt budget?
That was last week.
Shortcase. Next Sunday from America.
It's easy to get lost in this.
As we mentioned at the top of the show as well, when we were talking about John Delaney, there is a story in the Sunday Independent as well of one of the smaller sporting organisations in Ireland, Cricket Ireland. Yep.
Do you want to see that, Rory?
His CEO, Warren Deitrim, had to give a loan to his association of €100,000. And as we said, documents seen by the Sunday Independent, the loan was properly documented in a loan agreement at the time. However, the board was not informed until recently after details of John Delaney's controversial loan of €100,000 became public. But details of the loan are recorded in Cricket Ireland's financial accounts, which will be presented to members at its annual general meeting at the weekend. A briefing note appeared ahead of a board meeting on April 10th, sets out the details of the loan and paints a stark picture of the deterioration in the association's financial situation. And the Sunday Independent, they have been given tons of information here by Cricket Ireland on why the loan was needed, when it was paid back, and there's just so much clarity in it, and that's why you're probably not raising as many questions.
Yeah, it's that classic thing. It just goes back to even that bloody shambles in the Oireachtas, you know, like anything. If you can get out and you can control the message. Mm-hmm. If you inform people like this here, you know, it's very detailed. And it's that classic thing of the minute in the media, if you leave a vacuum, as they did last week, you know, people are going to go and fill it, and they're going to find it other ways, you know. But yeah, they've come out here, they've been transparent about it. It just pales in comparison to what, you know, what's been going on with the FAI over the last 5 or 6 weeks. Like,
yeah, and a lot of the detail in it actually kind of paints a stark picture of how financially strapped some of the smaller sporting organisations in the country are. Because, like, just a couple of lines here. Around that time, Deitrim also asked the senior management team to defer their salaries for a week to help alleviate the crisis, which he says they were all very happy to do. He offered a €100,000 loan, having exhausted all other potential sources of funding, including the ICC, Sport Ireland and Bank of Ireland. Furthermore, Cricket Ireland did not breach any of its grant conditions with Sport Ireland, having notified them of their difficulties.
Because one of the things around the FAI thing, people have questioned why Sport Ireland haven't done more. You know, because like John Tracy and Kieran Mulvey would be there as long as John Delaney has been in the FAI. And But I think a large part of that is that I think Sport Ireland invests a huge amount of its energies on the sporting bodies outside the big three of the FAI, GA and IRFU, because they're seen as very as big and you know, they're big international bodies, and that the other sporting bodies need more help. And a lot of them are always, there's none of them that are massively profitable. Mm-hmm. You know, they're all very close to the line every year. And it's interesting when you look back to, there's reference here, when Jutrum took over at the end of 2006, Cricket Ireland was €260,000 in the black. Yeah. But you know, the last couple of accounts, a deficit of nearly 85,000 in 2016, nearly 60,000 in 2017, and it's going to report another deficit of 2018. And that's as a byproduct of cricket in the last, those 13 years since Warren has come in, has been very successful. Mm-hmm. You know, but that's come at a cost. Like the tri-series with New Zealand and Bangladesh and Malahide and Clontarf 2 years ago, it cost over $700,000 a stage, but it took it returned only $342,575 in revenue. And cricket doesn't have the infrastructure to be a huge international sport, so that often needs temporary things. So like temporary grandstands had to be built, marquees erected, a media centre installed, a broadcasting centre installed. For the England game in September 2013, they did basically a 10,000 capacity pop-up stadium. So it's, in a way, it's probably come ahead of schedule that suddenly cricket took off to a fair extent, mm-hmm. and was competing with, Ireland were competing with big teams, but they didn't have the financial backing to deal with that. And, you know, you have to give him credit for giving them a digger. Like Warren Jutrum wouldn't have been on John Delaney.
No.
Type salary,
absolutely. Yeah.
So for him to do that, you know, was quite a gesture.
And just even like the small things that the, you know, the contingencies, we have to take responsibility for the position we're in. We can't take all the praise and then blame others for what we're doing. They're talking about Ireland's first Test match here, and they're saying just the impact the rain has. But in the, I'm thinking. About rain on day one of the Test match, of €100,000 that should have been revenue, we were only able to get 25% because that's all the insurance market was prepared to give us. The full refund to 5,100 spectators for day one hit us hard.
Yeah.
Like small that margins, is, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, you know, 5,000 paying customers that you have to refund straight away.
Yeah. No, it's a challenge, it's a struggle. I actually think the Sunday Inner is very good today. Now, it's their best week in a long time. It's the best of all the papers this weekend. But like, and it's also, it's got a mixture of news and comment. Like, that's a really good news story with detail in it. And the GA piece with Dermot Crowe, there's a lot of detail in that. And then we'll come to the Paul Kimmich thing in a while. I think there's a good read in there. But this is very interesting, just in a broader sense, in that it shows the challenges for so many sports that are outside the top tier. Mm. Like you go through all the papers today, virtually all the papers have soccer, 99% of the coverage is soccer, GA, rugby, golf and horse racing.
Yeah.
And horse racing basically because Irish Grand Nationals tomorrow. If that wasn't on, it mightn't have any Grand Nationals racing other than the results. So, but there's 73 national governing bodies under the auspices of Sport Ireland. So the rest are living off scraps, and that affects everything from sponsorship to state funding, etc. So it's always a struggle for them. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, will we move on? Yeah. I think next on our agenda, we'll talk about the reaction to Munster's defeat yesterday.
Oh yeah.
A couple of pieces. One of them, Neil Francis, you spoke about this morning here in Meath.
Yeah, one of the things I've said, because he mentioned in passing, and it hadn't really occurred to me that genuinely, I think the best atmosphere I ever experienced at Croke Park was the Leinster-Munster Heineken Cup semi-final. I'd forgotten it was 10 years ago, but it was just, like the noise level was unreal. Like maybe when Kevin McManaman scored the goal for Dublin in the 2011 All-Ireland final, the stands actually shook. Yeah. Like it was so loud, like that as a moment. But as a whole game, that it was hopping. I know, you know, you had the Ireland England game as well.
Were you at that one?
Yeah. But like that was a great atmosphere. But I thought Leinster Munster was ahead of it that day. Oh. But they haven't really recovered. Yeah. I hadn't really thought, but Munster have never really kicked back from that. Like how many semi-finals have they lost now since then?
Seven in a row.
Yeah. You know, and basically Neil makes the point that. He brings in the comparison with the Premier League in soccer that you have the top six, United, City, Liverpool, Arsenal, Chelsea and Tottenham. And nobody outside that group will win anything other than an FA or League Cup. Yeah. And he said Munster are now the equivalent of an Everton or Leicester. Yeah. You know, Pro 14, they might win the odd time, but they're just not contenders in Europe anymore. They're perennial losing semi-finalists.
Yeah, I think the last...
So how do you break that glass ceiling now for
the Munster? Last kind of season and nearly two seasons of Europe probably shown us where the hierarchy is. You kind of have Leinster, Saracens and Racing 92.
Yeah.
After that, Munster, probably Toulouse this year, you'd probably put in there. They're at the top of the best of the rest category. Yeah, yeah. But there is a bit of a gap to get up to the best.
How do you bridge that? Is it finances or what? Do you need a lot more money or what?
This is the thing, and it's only going to get harder next season because we've got this whole private equity firm CVC who are going to be pouring millions into the Premiership. Mm-hmm. So you're going, and we're in a World Cup year, so. You think, you know, if we get to October, all these lads, all these All Blacks, Wallabies, South Africans, they're going to be heading up. They're going to be heading up to Europe.
They take their hiatuses for a couple of years.
That's it. Come top up the pension, and they're the guys who can afford to get them, or, you know, the Leicesters and the Saracens, and you know this kind of thing. And like, it's funny you go back to the Croke Park and go back to the glory days of Munster. Like I remember Munster, you know, remember the days when Munster were signing, you know, Doug Howlett and Ruud de Póki. You know, those guys were just. Can't get these guys anymore, you know. You have to. That's why. So, I don't know. There's going to be. We're getting to that time every year now where it's just a reality check, and Munster get to the stage, and it's just, you know, they're just not good enough, and whether that's.
Yeah, and yesterday was a real reality check.
Yeah. I wasn't there, no, myself, but I was just talking to a few of the guys who were there yesterday, and it was a weird one. I don't know. People felt, but even about 10 minutes into it, it just felt there was a sense of inevitability about it. I just kind of felt they were. It was just sort of almost a containment, and you felt eventually it was just the black waves were going to come and they were just going to get overpowered. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting. Yeah, Neil has some good lines in there. I think the best one going back to Croke Park is when he says, we did not know after the semi-final loss to Leinster in 2009 how long it would take to build the cathedral. Notre Dame will be completed in 5 years' time, by which time Munster will be no closer to their great sides of 06 and 08. Like, it's a fair point, like, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a hard one, and I don't know what the direction is. Is it a case of, you know, is it more recruitment promoting from within? There's a good branch of, probably the best branch of youngsters they have coming through in a long time. There's about five or six of them in the under-20s. And is it a case of fast-tracking these guys in? Everything's up to debate. Everything's up for debate now with Munster.
Yeah, because like three semi-finals in a row, and these probably have been the 3 years where the key players, the likes of Conor Murray, Peter O'Mahony, Simon Zeebo, you know, for the two previous seasons, Keith Earls. These are the peak years for those guys. They're at the late 20s, hitting 30. Within a couple of years' time, you know, you'd imagine anyway, age would dictate that they'd probably be on the wane. Yeah. And then you have this group of young players who might be coming through at the moment, but they might be a few years off hitting their peak as well.
Yeah.
Mm. So it's a tough cycle to break.
Yeah, and it's I think it's one of those things. It's like it's in any sport. I think Munster were just blessed back in that era. They just, you know, it was one of those anomalies where they just had five or six of these just icons, and they're all in the same team. You think of Foley, O'Gara, O'Connell, even guys like Leamy and David Wallace and Quinlan, and it was just they had a nucleus of a team. Mm-hmm. And then they had a guy like Declan Kidney who just, he understood how to harness that, and it was all just...
They were probably a group that had to learn how to grow up fairly quickly, I'd say, as well, that kind of early 2000s.
Yeah, they had a very strong identity as well. Yeah. Is that identity there now? Is it a strong... You know, I know people say, like the outside players who come in and say, oh, how they feel Munster and they've bought into it, but I wonder, is it as strong as those guys, really? I don't know.
So I kind of question every now and again. Yeah. But I kind of still end up going back to, I think it probably is still quite, it might be as strong as it was 10, 12 years ago, but it's certainly very strong. Like, for example, look at yesterday. Okay, there was only 16 or so thousand people at the semi-final, which is a pretty depressing attendance. But 8,000 to 10,000 of that was Munster fans.
Yeah, but I don't mean with supporters, I mean with players. Like, did the squad, like, so many of those guys were just, they bled Munster red.
Yeah.
Like, you know, everybody bleeds red.
Yeah.
But they were Munster.
They bled Munster red, very specific.
But they were part
red,
of the tradition, like, then they really bought into it. Like, I just, I'm not sure now if that's the case. I don't know. Like, I'm speculating. I don't know what you think.
I wrote about it actually on the point that I just it's not a you know, guys like Chris Farrell and Klein and Byrne, they've bought into it and they've brought a huge amount to Munster. But I just wonder that kind of what kind of made them that great side back in the noughties was there was that bit of a chip on the shoulder and you know, no, were just a bunch of lads, but you locals from Cork and Limerick and Clare Tip and Lean or whatever, and I just wonder when you, it's gradually, is that just being eroded slightly, you know? It just, when it comes to these big days when, like, what made Munster able to compete with those big giants back then was just that getting to that emotional play. And I just wonder when it goes back to the GA mentality of, you know, we're from the town or from the parish, kind of, Paul O'Connell used to call it going to the well. It was just something, was it something tangible or palpable? And when you have a team of, you know, I think out of the 23 yesterday, only 11 were local lads. So I don't know, I just wonder, is there something there in it? And
yeah,
something
because
they might
like
need
in
to
an
look
era
at
sports science, some people, you know, a lot of people do scoff at the notion of emotion, but
yeah, it's still
I always
thing,
thought
like,
it was important for Limerick, or sorry, for Munster. Mm. The emotion always gave Munster a little bit of an edge, you know, and I think, you know, that can be rooted in where you're from. You know, and if you're not from the place, even though you love the jersey and you buy into it and you love the club, it's still a gig. Mm, like, you're there because they signed you. And it could have been Saracens that signed you, could have been somebody else. You know?
Yeah, it's a weird thing actually, even because Saracens don't have any of that. They don't have any, like, kind of the history. They don't have much, as you saw yesterday, they don't have much of a fan base. Like Donegal Callan.
As you mentioned, you mentioned Donegal Callan's column from, was it yesterday?
Or Saturday morning, it's excellent. Like, and he said it's, you know, there's stories about big French teams like Clermont going up the bus and suddenly they start pulling into the club and they're like, is this where Saracens play?
It's like an industrial estate.
But O'Callaghan likened it to, it was very funny, likened it to, you know, visit to IKEA on a Sunday morning. Like, but then 2 hours later you get on the bus and you're like, what the hell was that? Like, and there, you've got to give a lot of credit to Mark McCall because he's just created something there that he's almost manufactured it, a kind of a sense of identity from, you know, but effectively it's a representative side, you know.
Yeah, and it's someone I was speaking to our colleague Gavin O'Reilly about as well today. Are Saracens and by extension Mark McCall, do they get the credit they actually deserve in Ireland? Okay, everyone gives them their due credit over in England. Everyone knows how good they are. I've always found over here there's always been a little bit of turning up the nose at them because they come from, you know, there's money there.
Yeah.
Because there's this idea that they kind of bought their way into success. They might have done that initially, but they're producing young players at a rate of knots. Mm. And they're just consistently improving and consistently getting better. And, you know, an Irish coach over there in Mark McCall. And I don't know, for me anyway, it's felt like they probably don't get that much credit on this island.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good point. And even, just even McCall, it's where, you know, with...
Like, we line out what Paul O'Connell's doing abroad, what Ronan O'Gara is doing.
Yeah, you've heard
when Jackman was over in France, we were applauding the work he was doing. Just seems we're not really doing that for Mark McCall. Is it just Saracens are a bit unfashionable to like?
Yeah, I can't get my head around it because I just think he's a guy who he came in there in 2011. He's been a mainstay and he's just created something clearly very special. Clearly he's able to motivate people, is able to put a good team around him. But as you said, we're very quick to sort of laud the people abroad. Mm. Like, but I rarely see him included in the conversations about, you know, even there's stuff, just talk about Andy Farrell, his new attack coach, you know. Mm. Like McCall would jump out of me as a guy to jump into the mix there. But and there's also a perception of them that they're a bit one-dimensional and they're quite a negative side. But you saw them yesterday, they play a good brand of rugby. I mean, they're not sort of a freewheeling to lose, but, you know, they're easy on the eye as well. And
up until yesterday, they were averaging, 34 points and 4 tries a game.
Yeah, it's
decent going.
Yeah, it's not bad, you know. But I can see the thing, they're hard to like, and there are things coming out, there are sort of...
Speaking of hard to like.
That moves us on.
Man of the match yesterday.
Man of the match.
And our great old friend Stephen Jones, never fails to disappoint, but...
The headline for a start anyway, I'll just hold it up here.
Tone is,
if you want to zoom in on that. Vuna Pola enjoys last laugh over Boo Boys. And the paragraph in question, it was after Billy Vuna Pola yesterday scored a try and was given man of the match by BT in the win yesterday. All of this after the week he's had where he had come under a lot of criticism for his comments, which I suppose supported Israel Folau's stance on homosexuals. And Vunipola himself said that God created men for women to procreate, along those lines.
Yeah.
Saracens and the ORFU said that they have warned him essentially over his comments. Vunipola, he hasn't really apologised for any of it though.
No, and he kind of doubled down in an interview after yesterday.
So he was booed yesterday by the Munster fans. There was one Munster fan that came onto the pitch afterwards and confronted him.
In hush puppies.
No socks.
This paragraph from Stephen Jones, I think, jumped out for all three. The occasion was diminished by the constant abuse by Munster fans of Billy Vunipola. He had a tangential part in the Israel Folau affair last week.
Interesting.
But gradually his reaction has been better understood.
By Stephen Jones, but nobody else.
So whether the shocking abuse of a great player was just a reaction to Vunipola being way too good for them, or whether it was a stand by Munster people against homophobia, something of which Vunipola has never been guilty, then it was distasteful. So too shouts and general noise when Owen Farrell was preparing for kicks at goal. So too the idiot who ran onto the field after Vunipola did a TV interview, waving his hands in the face of the big man. The fool was later detained. Now, granted that your man who ran onto the pitch yesterday was a fool, and all it's kind of done is probably created an image of Vunipola being some sort of victim a little bit more, but I just thought that was a bizarre,
no. It's off the wall. It's completely tone deaf by Stephen Jones. Like he should have more cop on than to come out with this kind of crap. And he's not alone in this. Like BT,
be honest now. I only saw the interview the BT did with Vunipola after the game. I didn't hear the commentary during the match.
When he got
in a dark radio studio for the day, so it's relying on just pictures. But a lot of people weren't happy with
that. Yeah, like when he got the try, it was something along like after the week he's had, you know, a kind of redemption story. And I think in sport we're often guilty of this, that we want redemption stories, but he created the problem for himself.
Yeah.
And he made a messy situation even messier.
Yeah.
And I've no sympathy for him. And why say, no, this is a great redemption story? He arguably should have been dropped for the bloody game because he was completely out of order. And like giving them that award when they didn't have to was off the wall. It was Austin Healey.
Yeah.
Is that a case of
if we give him the man of the match, we know we're going to be able to interview him?
Yeah. Could possibly be, because you could make an argument he was man of the match, but you could have made an argument for four or five other players. And given what's going on, I think it was a really bad choice. It's a terrible signal. But they just want this to be part of their redemption story, that he was getting man of the match and they could interview him afterwards. It's not like he was challenged about what he said afterwards or what he tweeted. So.
The closest thing that resembled an apology was, it was never my intention to insult or to hurt people. But even if it wasn't your intention to do it...
It still did it.
Yeah. Even if I don't intend to do something and I do something, I'd probably apologise for doing it.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting to hear your opinions on this. I just find the whole... I just don't know why there's this drive to, you know, why he felt the need to, as someone said, place himself in the storm, like, and like through social media, it's kind of, you know, if you wanna go to a forum, if you wanna go debate it publicly and have your views challenged, I'm all for that. But just to kind of weigh in on it, and as a lot of ex-players have said this week, you know, if you read the post, it's cumbersome, it's quite, you know, it's messy the way he writes it. His argument doesn't really come across. And then just kind of, as you said, double down at it. And even just from a professional point of view, you know, the biggest week of your team's season and you go in and you do that, like, you know. But I'm the same as you. I found the tone of BT Sport throughout it a bit strange and a bit kind of, you know, obviously he's a huge personality over there and they know it's their bread is butter, they're deeply embedded. Obviously, they have the rights to the Gallagher Premiership, but I found it all strange. Like, there's rumours as well that there's apparently a clip of one stage with the commentary and it's now being taken off Twitter, like, because it's a bit of, you know, oh, he had the hardest week of his career and he's come through and all that. And I just found it all a bit bizarre, really.
Yeah.
But if you're a gay professional rugby player, like, you would really think twice about coming out when all this stuff is going on.
Well, also, like, on the other side, you have Nick Heath, who is a BT Sport rugby commentator, who posted a brilliantly powerful message on Twitter last week and has spoken about it. I'd say he probably felt a bit strange seeing some of his colleagues, you know, borderline lionising Billy Vunipola yesterday for, you know, redeeming himself, silencing his critics. Yeah. I saw someone writing that actually last night, silence the critics. I don't think any of his critics were criticising his ability to score a try in a semi-final.
Yeah, no. People weren't questioning. You know, everyone knows he's absolutely brilliant and bright and things, but it's just... It was odd. You know, as you said about redemption, it's more about, you know, actual setbacks in your life, not actually creating a whole storm by your own doing, you know? Strange one.
We'll move on from Munster to Leinster today. Rory, you're going to be going to Aviva later on. Devin Toner was across most of the Sunday papers today, but you went a different way.
Yeah, my good friend.
Sort of a profile on Johnny Sexton.
It's been a really... He spoke yesterday actually at Aviva, and it was really, I don't know if you saw it, a really interesting quote where he said, you know, when he went to Monte Carlo for the World Player of the Year, the big bash after November internationals, when he's at his peak after we've beaten the All Blacks. And he was kind of asked, you know, what was your mindset? And he said, you know, I said to my wife Laura, he said, you know, if I win, brilliant. You know, if I lose, fine. If I win, you know, this is going to be another thing to beat me with, you know. And it's kind of been the way. It's been a funny old 6 months for him because, last year him, like Ireland had the greatest year of all time, and he was, you know, he was at the centre of all
front
of it.
Front and centre of it, yeah.
And it's kind of a bit like Ireland. It's sort of unravelled a bit over the last 5 or 6 months. Like as we were saying out there, it's one of the quirks of the central contracts. He was pretty much every present for Ireland in the Six Nations, and he hasn't played for Leinster since late December. It's kind of a bizarre
thing.
Against
Munster, bizarrely, it was the last game he actually played for Leinster, which I hadn't really thought about it until you came in and we were talking about it this morning. It has been a very difficult few weeks for him, few months from, as you mentioned, ever since being named World Player of the Year. But like, have you been able to put your finger on what the issue is?
Has
he been able to, do you wonder?
It's one of those things, I suppose it's like form, it's kind of, they're all kind of linked together, but it's a weird one. The thing that always jumped out at me, I know people like to make big deals, we love drama and we love like flashpoints.
We love redemption stories, we've been talking about.
But I always go back to, he's always been a very fiery character, but I always go back to, as you said, that game at Tobin when Finian Witcherly, you know, the young buck from Munster, came out and flattened him. And, you know, that the moment of whips it at him, and he just seems a bit more frustrated than usual. But as I said there, I wouldn't put it past him to go out today and just absolutely kill it.
Yeah.
He's got that kind of mentality, you know.
Absolutely. But, but you wouldn't know, unless you're in somebody's shoes, you don't know the pressure they're feeling. And after being made World Player of the Year, going into World Cup year, when Ireland have been talked of as potential winners, like the pressure on his shoulders is immense. Like on a number 10 anyway, it would be immense, but given he got that award and the World Cup coming up, like you don't know psychologically, has it been difficult for him? You know, no matter how mentally strong he is.
Is there a fear, I wonder, like this could be completely off the wall now and you can tell me if it, like, I wonder, is there a fear in maybe a few of the players' heads of actually being afraid of peaking too early? Of that they were going into the Six Nations thinking, What happens if we absolutely blow the lights out here?
Yeah.
Like, is everyone going to know everything about us? And I'm not going to say that they deliberately held anything back, but, you know, subconsciously, are you afraid of going a little step further?
Yeah, they were definitely cranky during the Six Nations. Mm. They weren't themselves. Like, you could see that, I know it was highlighted on TV and stuff, with the body language at different times, and they were snapping at each other, and it just didn't seem as united as it was a few months earlier. And that can be a sign of the pressure.
Yeah.
You know, because there's no experience of that kind of pressure with Ireland. You know, like 07, that was hyped up a bit, but not to the same extent. Mm. You know, I think now people genuinely did, and some still do, think Ireland could give the World Cup a real rattle. But those guys... No, they know Ireland have never won a quarter final. Like and a likely quarter final would be against South Africa, who tend to get right in World Cup years.
So they look like they're getting right as well.
Yeah.
I always say to people who come to me and say, you know, what do you read into the Six Nations? I always say it's a bit like, you know, 2-season show on Netflix or something, you know, like if you're a bit unsure at the end, give it the second, you know, wait till the second part and, you know, you might reveal it. I have a feeling that Joe and even guys like Johnny and stuff, you know, I think they've thrown everything at the World Cup. And as you said about peaking, you go back to 2015. They went to that World Cup as back-to-back Six Nations champs, and we all know what happened, like, you know. So I just think it kind of works both ways. That's what I'd be telling myself, trying to be optimistic about things, you know. I've been to enough World Cups and got stung, you know. But
in terms of Toulouse as well, you were writing about Leinster Prime to spike Toulouse's thrilling revival. It has been a brilliant revival.
That's great.
Because I think, as we said outside, for rugby fans of my age at least, it just feels right to see Toulouse being back up there, playing in the big games, playing in the big semi-finals, and playing that style of rugby that they are, where they have these big brute forwards like the likes of Rory Arnold and Richie Gray and these guys, but the stuff they're doing out in the back line with Cheslin Colby, it's just amazing to watch.
Yeah, I mean, we asked Luke McGrath last week about, you know, have you ever played 10, and he said something like, played like 20 minutes when I was back at Michael's or something, like, and it's just to lose a score. Yeah, off you go. You go, Anton, play 10. You know, it's great because obviously, as I said, when we were younger, like, Toulouse were just brilliant. Like, they were just a great team. It's a bit like the Ajax during the week. It's like an old giant coming back.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a thing that even when Leinster lost in October in that game, you know, the reaction from everyone was like, oh, it's just great to see them back. Like, and I think they're here to stay. And it's, I think they've kind of gone back. They were in the wilderness for a few years, and Ugo Mole and Fabian Palouse, now, do you remember him? He's the director of rugby, and they just kind of stripped it all back. And
Reggie Son as well.
Yeah, the Vandenman. Yeah, that's what I learned. Like, West Cork is just, you know, the tales of redemption. Like, a lot of things happened down there, but it's just brilliant. And I'm looking forward to saying, I think maybe, as we said outside, I think Leinster, just their pedigree and their experience, I think they'll have enough today, but I think we're going to see, unfortunately for the likes of Munster, we're going to see Toulouse at this stage of the competition for the next 5 or 6 years, definitely. The nucleus of that team, very young team. But it's just great. It's good.
Speaking of good throwbacks to the late 90s and early 2000s, Tiger Woods, plenty of coverage of his Masters win last week across the papers. There are a couple of bits we picked out as well. Kieran, which is the first one you want to go with?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of the two positive, like Dermot Gillies, who went to the Augusta for basically lap of honour his last Masters. So he writes a fine piece. He always writes well about just hooking it on Tiger's mental strength, and, you know, putting it in context in golf history. And Oliver Holt is a very good piece in the Mail. But the piece that jumped out at me was Paul Kimmage's, because I can see where he's coming from this, because you know the old WBH line, how can we know the dancer from the dance? Tiger Woods, a brilliant golfer, from what we know of him as a person. And he tells a few stories about him that I think are quite telling about, you know, his reluctance to tip staff. Yeah. And
It's from his first professional win.
Yeah.
In Las Vegas, where Butch Harmon had to tip the locker room staff.
Yeah.
$300, which by all accounts isn't enough.
And then
he was just oblivious to the fact that he should have been tipping them in the first place.
Yeah, and then there's another story, because remember Tiger, there was reports he was obsessed with Navy SEALs, and he trained with them, and Wright Thompson wrote about this, and five or six of them went for dinner, and the waitress came to the bill, and everybody went silent, and he made no move to pay. So eventually somebody said, oh, give us six separate bills. But I think the most interesting story was that after his father, Errol Woods, died, that they presumed the local Manhattan Monuments, who make gravestones, a local outfit near the graveyard in Kansas, where he's buried, expected to get an order from Tiger Woods and the family for a gravestone, and maybe a particularly ornate one. But they got no call. And 10 years passed, and there's no grave marker. It's an unmarked grave. Which is really, really strange. Like, he's an odd fish.
Yeah.
You know, and it ends up, Paul Kimmage says he happened to course one of the best big golf writers in the US afterwards, said, what do you think? He says, I feel nothing. Like, there is that, even watching him being interviewed after, like, he did show emotion when he won it. But afterwards, he was just, there's something really cold and detached about him. Like, I find it really hard to warm to him, I have to be honest.
How did you watch it live last?
No, I was on the way back from a wedding in Donegal. No, I watched a bit of it later on, like I've ever been recorded. So yeah. Just to see.
I was here last Sunday watching it, and you know, we were watching it. Like it was absolutely gripping entertainment, yeah. And stuff. And when he sang the winning pot, I went, oh, you know, what a story and all that. I can absolutely see where Paul Cambridge is coming from in it, though, because yeah. There are so many stories about him that just leave you feeling that little bit cold.
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe it was that I was in the vicinity of Joe Malloy when Tiger won, so I just fed off the energy. But did you see it, Rory?
Yeah, I was actually in the office at the Daily Mail, and it was nice. It took our minds off other things for a couple of hours. It was just a nice story. But it's as you said, it's a weird thing with him, because obviously this incredible, you know, competitor, this God-given talent, and obviously like he was emotionally and physically broken. But I think Kimmich does really well of, and I share his view, that he just seems like a very contrary, kind of strange character. There's a great line there where he's just talking about all the, talking about his stinginess, but all the deals, like, you know, 30 million from Buick, 26.5 million American Express, Rolex, EA Sports deals, golf, you know, Wheaties, and then, but then the payoff is, you know, you'd rarely see him signing autographs or engaging with kids. You know, it's that sort of, there's a coldness there, you know?
Yeah, because there's an interesting one here, Neil. Paul has gone to see him, watched him play a lot and win big a lot. Like he mentioned, being a Congressional for US Open, Troon for the Open, Wingfoot for PGA, Soto Grande with Ryder Cup. Was there to watch him play Waterville 99, his 10-shot win at Pebble Beach, there for the Tiger Slam in Augusta in 2001. So he's watched him a hell of a lot. Mm. And he says that the more we saw of him, the less there was to cheer, which I think is an interesting line. And I often find this that, I don't know if you guys agree, but if you interview somebody and you like them, you're biased afterwards, I find.
Yeah.
That you can often watch a game, or if it's an individual sport, you always want them to do well.
Yeah.
And it's completely irrational, like, because you don't even know if the interview is what somebody is really like. Anybody can put on an act for 20 minutes or an hour or whatever.
You just take to someone on a personal level.
Yeah, because I think people have read before, first impressions, people make a first impression after 7 seconds after meeting somebody, decide what they think of them. But because I remember just in a rugby mix zone, there's one player who was very fond of spitting lumps of chewed apple in your direction when he was also talking. Yeah, yeah. So I didn't shed any tears when he retired. Yeah. And he was a very good player, but you do, perceptions count. So Paul has seen of Tiger, and even stuff like not signing autographs for kids and stuff, it does colour your impression of somebody. And I think it does taint his legacy a bit. I think you have to be a bit more human, and you have to be a bit more given to yourself and realise how lucky you are.
Mm-hmm. And it does seem in the last couple of years he's clearly working on that image a little bit. Mm. But it seems that no matter what he does, people will always still have it in his head that he's trying to work on, you know, he's trying to change who he actually is.
Yeah. Donald Trump.
Deep down he is that kind of, he's just a cold, pretty cold person.
Deep down, he's very shallow.
Yeah. The cynic in me would say, is there, I don't know, I just spitballing, but like, does he have a team behind him, and they're pushing that? Is he in a room with a bunch of guys going, we need you to do this, and we need you to be more human, Tiger, you know? I just wonder.
Oliver Holt's piece then, it's probably less about Tiger Woods himself, it's probably more just about the impact Tiger Woods has on golf.
Yeah.
That, you know, I thought it was a really interesting colour piece on being there at Augusta when he wins, and that the headline, Tiger found his refuge from reality, and it's probably just about how much he captures the sport, really. The opening paragraph is fantastic. Talking about the drive he has from Alabama to Augusta, I think it was last year or something like that, on his way to the Masters. And he's driving through these roads and, you know, stopping off at the trucker stops, and the yellow of the Waffle House sign was still lit up, and the customers perched on stools at the counter, cops with the lights on watching things go by. And then the last paragraph of it, outside Hooters, John Daly's RV was in darkness.
It's probably the best written piece in all the Sundays. Like, it's really evocative. It's really, like, it's something you would have read from, you know, one of the new journalism masters of the 1970s or something. Like, it really reads that way. Like, and I think he's he's deliberately adopted that kind of voice. Like, it's a very American road trip voice, and I like the piece a lot. Now it's more, it's kinder towards Woods. You know, it's it's not a. It's very impressionistic of picture of what it was like to be there. Like, it's not a, it's not reportage really. It's just it's color.
I think it paints a good description though. I think it paints a good description though of, like, despite all the flaws in him.
Yeah.
The golf fans still absolutely adore him, and he still is golf.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Yeah. Yeah, that might be worrying for golf, that nobody else has emerged, you know, that's captured the imagination that way. Maybe if Rory had won, would he have got that kind of glory? He might have got that kind of acclaim, given he would have won one of the few to do the Grand Slam.
Yeah.
And he does seem a popular figure, and he's become a more interesting figure as he's got older, Rory. He has more to say for himself. And but I don't know if it would get the acclaim that Tiger got, all right.
Mm-hmm. Another interesting part on it. When Woods was on the 18th tee, still out of sight around the fork in the fairway, a security guard pushed a small boy of 8 or 9 to the front of the section of the crowd and asked the patrons if he could stand there so he could see. He heard the murmur of excitement as Woods stood on the right of the fairway, ready to play his approach on that historic final hole. But when Woods walked towards the green and the crowd stood to laud him, whooping and roaring and applauding, it was too much. The boy darted away to find his parents. Maybe when he retells the experience in a few years to come, he'll admit his retreat from one of sport's defining moments.
Stuff.
Yeah, like, it just, I suppose, just the tension around the place, the size of the crowds. I remember I was at the Open last year at Carnoustie.
Okay.
And there was, you know, a spell for about an hour, 90 minutes on Sunday afternoon where Tiger was making a move and went to the top of the leaderboard briefly, and everyone was going, oh my God, it's happening.
Yeah.
And you could absolutely just feel the energy in the place lift.
Yeah.
Like, Rory McIlroy made a move, went to the top of the leaderboard. There was a bit of a, wow, McIlroy's after making a big birdie putt here or a big eagle putt.
Yeah.
But it was just nothing on the scale of Tiger.
Yeah.
And even when he was coming up towards 18, I remember just the rush of people trying to get over there just to see him. He was out of contention at this stage. Molinari was going to tap in and win the tournament, but people just had to be there to see Tiger finishing off, you know?
Yeah.
It just shows the grip he has on the sport.
Yeah, the power of his aura.
Yeah. We are running out of time here, probably just a few more minutes left. There was a piece on Liverpool in the Sunday Times.
Oh, yeah, I find that very interesting because it's Jonathan Northcroft, but he mentions it. It's a guy I actually follow on Twitter. He's a rabid Liverpool fan. He's a bit one-eyed about Liverpool, Simon Brundish. But he's a very well-regarded sports scientist. And it just gives an inkling into why Liverpool are where they are. And a large part of it is, there's a line he uses a lot, Brundish, availability, the most underrated of all the abilities. And seven key men this season for Liverpool: Salah, Alisson, Van Dijk, Firmino, Mane, Robertson, and Wijnaldum have only missed seven league games between them, which is extraordinary. And it's actually it's built into the recruitment. Like, Alisson has never had a significant injury. He's missed only one match since coming to Europe 3 years ago. Salah's only missed a couple of matches in his career. His longest ever injury break was 4 weeks. Robertson has had one injury layoff ever. Wijnaldum has basically been injury-free for 5 years. Firmino and Mane hardly ever get injured. Van Dijk had an ankle one issue. He was out for... he's only experienced one issue, ruling him out for longer than 4 days, having his appendix out in 2011-2012. Fabinho has missed one game through injury in his entire career. When you look at City, like, De Bruyne is injured again. Mm-hmm. Like, and it's one of the things I've often thought about is... I remember a couple of years ago, the Phillips Manager of the Year award, it was shared between Pete Taylor and Billy Walsh because of the Olympic medals in London 2012. Yeah. I remember a lot of the boxes were given out that Zora and Antia should have been honoured as well. because he was a brilliant technical coach. And like say, but like Declan Kidney won that award, and Declan would have had kicking coach, scrum coach, backs coach, forward coach, etc. Like if Liverpool won the league, it'll all be Klopp's brilliant job. But it's not just about the manager. People forget that. Like he
the size of a GAA background.
Yeah, like he obviously is a brilliant medical and physio team and coaches, and they. Jonathan starts that off by mentioning you probably saw the pictures of Salah on a beach during the international break, and that how Salah in the last couple of weeks, like he looked gone for the months before that.
Yeah, and as
but he's
says
just
here
been
as well,
in blistering form now that it's all when they need him most.
Yeah, Klopp's belief in rest is such that he's taken Liverpool on 8 mid-season training camps during his 3.5 years in charge.
Yeah.
So there's always this focus on. You know, whether it's by design or by accident that they might have been out of a few cups and things like that, but it presents the opportunity to have these little breaks and just
because I remember looking at that before, and I think the game directly after each of those breaks, I think they've either drawn or lost. They haven't a great record at it, but March, April, the results have been really strong, and that seems to be when the effect of a mid-season training break kicks in. Mm-hmm. So it just shows you these things don't happen. By accident, like players are recruited not just for their ability, it's often because they're injury free and also the importance of medical staff, but it's just a different slant on it. I thought it was something different.
Yeah, and there's a nice breakdown as well on the just on the side there as well. Klopp's Liverpool points in Premier League games from February towards the end of the season. 2016 is 1.73, 2017 it was 2. 2018, 1.92, so more or less the same. And 2019, now it's 2.4.
Yeah.
So you can see the benefits it's having towards the end of a campaign.
Yeah, you wonder as he kind of tailored it, because I remember when he first came in, wasn't the whole press was the fact that he was running them into the ground.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was because they needed
last
to play.
Last year, the distances they were covering, they were constantly churning out those stats.
Yeah,
there was a big second...
Second half of the season, they collapsed a bit. So he's clear. Well, they've changed the way they play. Like they're not. It's
not
the gung ho.
They're
more controlled now. And also, I think he has changed. He's definitely changed coaching staff. I think he's changed medical staff as well. So that impacts. Because I remember, when Guardiola was at Bayern, he had very public rows with medical staff and the doctors over players getting injured. So. There is something to it, I think.
What I found really interesting with Liverpool actually is, even just aside from physically how they're looking sharp, they're actually looking mentally a lot fitter over the last couple of months.
That staggers me because they looked riddled with nerves in January, February.
I remember the Crystal Palace game.
Yeah, they look really confident now when the pressure should be on them to a greater extent.
And I think it's feeding into the fans as well.
Yeah,
I remember, it's Crystal Palace is the game that stands out for me.
Yeah.
Might be different games for other people, but remember the sheer nerves around Anfield the game.
Yeah, Crystal Palace, Burnley and Leicester, those games were really nervy. Brighton away, there was a few of those really nervy.
You look at Chelsea last week and Spurs the week before. The games where they probably should have been nervous and they probably should have been edgy, the players looked sharp, they looked confident, they looked like they knew what they were going out to do, and the fans didn't seem overly worried either.
Yeah.
And the longer it goes on, they just seem to, they're coping a lot better with it.
Yeah. But it's amazing because I do think they'll fall short. I think they'll win 3 and draw 1 of the last 4. I think there'll be a draw somewhere. But that would mean they'll end up with 95 points. Which up to this season will be second highest points tally ever with one defeat, which has hardly ever been done. But they're still finished behind City, and people say they're lucky. So I don't know.
Well, you know, luck comes into it as well, just in terms of the picking up. Never mind the little hamstring injuries that you can manage and stuff, but it's the big injuries. Like Leicester a few years ago as well.
Yeah.
They used very small number of players.
Yeah, yeah.
They got lucky that their key men were around at the key.
Well, Liverpool, as that piece mentioned, have effectively used 15 players, in this day and age is amazing. Do you just want to finish, quick word on GA? Do you want to mention? Do
almost
you want to
take Rory first? You want to throw out there or highlight the GA piece, Rory, you want to mention?
Just very quickly, I'm biased, obviously, he's a colleague and a mate, but Shane's just done a nice kind of piece on David Clifford. He's this new starlet down in Kerry, and it's very good. He's kind of spoken to Derek Kinnage and a few guys who've kind of coached him and stuff, but it's just Shane's really, really good at that kind of stuff. And
Shane McGrath, isn't it?
Yeah, Shane McGrath, yeah. But just to kind of go off point a bit, just even today, 30 pages in the Mail on Sunday, and obviously there's been talk about cutbacks in our place, between designers and subs and, you know, the sports editor. I mean, there was four people put this paper together yesterday in the office.
Yeah,
and you know, yeah, 30 pages of sport. You know, and obviously we work with London and stuff, but I guess it just shows the climate we're in, and it just shows, you know, like the work and the toil that people are putting in to get. I think, you know, the paper looks good today. You know, it's just wanted to give a shout out to the guys who, you know, put in the work yesterday.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know,
what like, I found amazing is the 9 pages of GA, which the deserve
yeah,
credit
going.
For that, because I know from experience, April is a nightmare for, like, there's a lot of filler around GA-wise this month, because, like, the club stuff is more local media thing. I think it's not as much a national newspaper or national media outlet
until
stuff.
Until you get down to the business end of the competition.
Yeah, you just see a lot of waffly features around this month. Like, it's really, I think it's a problem for, it is a structural problem in even trying to market the games or sell. And it's a problem for, because a huge amount of people are mad GA fans and don't want to read about anything else. And it's a month where it's very hard to find anything that's interesting. So I think the Mail getting 9 pages out of this Sunday.
Yeah, they're under corn this weekend, the lads are like, what's the solution, do you think, Karen? Is it just more gigs, or is there something?
League-based championship. Yeah. You know, you need to change the calendar some way. Like, by all accounts, April isn't working. You know, it's just, there's a lot of disquiet over the April club month. So I think, I don't know, it's a big question, not an easy answer to it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, guys, we're out of time. Rory and Kieran, thanks for coming in.
Enjoy the
Aviva later on today. Yeah. And Kieran, enjoy a bit of family time.
Thanks.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.